My first guest this morning will be Elaine Romero. She's the playwright of Secret Things, a new play about the crypto-Jewish tradition in New Mexico. And it's now at the National Hispanic Cultural Center in Albuquerque and opening in Santa Fe August 16th for 2 weekends at Teatro Paraguas. Hello, Elaine. How are you this morning?
Well, I'm not Elaine, but...
Good morning, Mary Lynn LeBlanc, our engineer at KSFR.
Good morning, Hollis.
Good morning.
I've got one ear on the phone as it's ringing. I'm not getting an answer. But, you know, we talked about this possibility. So, Hollis, tell us about your radio experience.
Well, you know, it's really funny. I started the beginning of my journalistic career in radio. I was at the University of North Texas in Denton, Texas. And I'm not even sure I remember how I got involved, but I had a two-hour radio interview show, a talk show, rather, that I did with a friend of mine named Pam Seibert, and it was a feminist radio show. We played women's music. We talked about women in the news and feminist issues of the day. Occasionally, we would go out and interview people. I went to the first Women's International Conference ever in 1978 in Houston and interviewed luminaries of the feminist movement and used some of that tape on the radio there. So, and I did news there, and I did, you know, everything as kids in college radio systems do. And then, very luckily, I got my first real professional radio job while I was in college. I was the news director of the local radio station in Denton, KDNT. And it sounds really glamorous, and what it meant was I had to get up at 3:30 in the morning, and I had to go down with a key and open the door to the radio station at, you know, 4. And then back in those days, especially for you young folks who won't remember this, the wire services, to get the wire services like Associated Press or United Press International, we had these enormous machines that were about the size of a room-sized swamp cooler, and the wire came over this machine, and so I would have to go in and turn on the machine, and then it would download and print everything the wire service had moved overnight, and then I would sit there and sift through all of that junk and try to find out what stories I wanted to read on the air, and do that, and the weather, and all that kind of stuff, and then eventually some other folks would show up to run the station. But I even turned on the transmitter in the morning. I mean, you know, it was a full service deal.
So, Hollis, tell me, what was the feminist music of those days?
Oh gosh, there were people like Meg Christian and Holly Near, and Sweet Honey in the Rock. Some of those artists, you know, sort of transitioned into a more mainstream audience in later days, and a lot of those women are still making music. And I've actually seen some of them in concert in the Bay Area in recent years, so I know they're still around. It was a really fun time, a really different time. And my compatriot in that is still working at the University of North Texas, even all these many years past. And I still have reel-to-reel tapes of those programs. And I recently was thinking about, you know, clearing out my storage area, and I thought, you know, I should contact the university library and see if they're interested in that archival. It's now vintage, right? Archival material.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, I think it's timeless because you mentioned Holly Near, and one of my favorites of hers was Esta Mujer, whatever, you know, it was in Chile, and you know, a woman who disappeared, and it seems like the same stories are here today.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And so many of the same issues are here today. I mean, feminism as a movement has sort of taken a back seat to many other things happening on our political scene today. But, you know, as we all know and we all hear every year, when the Labor Department puts out its statistics, women still only earn like something like 75% of what men earn on the same jobs with the same backgrounds and things like that. So,
how do we get over that issue?
You know, you've got me. We keep focused on it, and we keep making it important. It's so easy for us to say, oh, well, that's been solved, because we see that, indeed, the glass ceiling has broken, and there are women rising to the top, and we all know one of these days we will have a woman president.
But will she be paid the same?
I certainly hope so. And I certainly hope she has a lot of female Secret Service workers guarding her. I think that would be very fun. But I have to go back to the radio thing. You know, the reason I'm on this show, sitting in for Mary Charlotte this summer, is because way back in the early days of the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, Honey Harris was the host for a while. And I was then, as I, for much of the last 15, 20 years, writing about art. And Honey asked me to come on the show every Friday and do a little segment about what was going on in the art scene. So every Friday morning, I would get up at the crack of dawn and come down here and then have about 10, 15 minutes with Honey where I talked about everything that was going on. And I did that with Honey, and then when Honey left the show and Mary Charlotte took over, I did it with Mary Charlotte. And today, Diana Delling is the legacy art speaker on Fridays. She does that segment with Mary Charlotte. And so it's just, you know, gone on and on. So when Mary Charlotte decided to take some time off, somebody said, well, you know, Hollis used to be on your show. Why don't you call her up? So it's afforded me a great opportunity to talk on the radio again and have a good time with you guys over in the station.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing this bit because I knew your name from somewhere, and until this moment, I didn't place it. You're that Hollis. I remember
that
when you
Hollis.
Were on Honey Show.
Yeah, well, and you know, I've lived here since 1987, and during in northern New Mexico, and during most of that time, I was working as a print journalist. I worked first when I came here for the Albuquerque Journal North, and I worked at the New Mexican for a very long time. I was at the New Mexican for 9 years and covered everything from, I think my first beat was courts, so I covered criminal and civil courts. And I did a lot of other jobs. I was the feature editor. I started the column, the gossip column called El Mitote, which I'm very proud of. And then I wrote about art for Pasatiempo, and I was the arts editor. I was the editor of Pasa and also the arts editor for the whole paper, which I think Christina Melcher holds that position today, both, you know, arts editor for Pasa, but also overseeing arts coverage for the entire paper. And it was a really good run. I had a great time at Pasa. And then in 2001, I think, I left and became a freelance writer. And continue to write primarily about fine art, but also sometimes about other topics, both locally and for national publications, art magazines, and things like that. So I've had a long and storied career, and so I still, what's amazing is that people have long memories. You know, to me, that time, like when I was at the New Mexican is a long time ago, but often, you know, even I'll be in a store and someone, or I called somebody on the phone yesterday and she said, I know your name. Didn't you used to work for the New Mexican in the 90s? I thought, wow, I have a profile. Isn't that wonderful?
You do. Are you still doing journalism besides what you do on the Radio Cafe?
Well, I'm still committing a little bit of journalism, as I like to say. I left here in 2008 and I moved to Berkeley. And
my favorite town.
Yeah. It's, you know, Santa Fe is sort of Berkeley light when it comes to the new age and politics and our liberal bent and all of that. When I went to Berkeley, it was like, oh, it's just like Santa Fe, only to the 10th degree. Anyway, I went to Berkeley, and I didn't have a plan at the time of what I was going to do exactly, but I ended up going to an interfaith seminary and becoming a minister. It was never on my agenda, never part of my plan, but that's what happened, and I went to become a minister, and then I went and did a year-long residency as a clinical chaplain at Kaiser Hospital there, which was a very profound and amazing experience, which continues to inform my life on a daily basis.
So how does an interfaith minister differ from a minister of a particular denomination?
Well, ministers of particular denominations or even clerics of any religious organization are attached to that organization and are trained by that organization, either in seminary or in a church or a synagogue or other kind of religious setting. And they hew to the dogma of that religion. And interfaith is not a religion, it's an idea. It's an idea that says all religions have value, all faiths have value, even the idea of no faith has value. And as an interfaith minister, my goal is to serve people of all faiths or no faith as they walk their paths in life. And so some of the things I do are very similar to what congregational ministers do, ministers who actually work for a church or a mosque or whatever. I do weddings. I do memorials. I do spiritual counseling one-on-one. I facilitate groups of people who talk about topics that are generally or somehow related to the spiritual in nature. And I do private chaplaincy. I have worked as I said, as a hospital chaplain and as a hospice chaplain. I'm not affiliated with any particular organization right now, but I do that work with individuals in my life, and it's the most rewarding work I've ever done.
It sounds very ecumenical.
Yes, it is.
In that respect. And you know, it's interesting because it was in Berkeley that I got involved in the ecumenical movement itself. So what a place for you to have begun this work.
Tell me about that. So how did you get involved? What did you do?
Well, I'm going to date myself. It's the late 60s. And and at the time I was a Catholic, and we had, Pope John the 23rd opening the doors and the windows to that great mausoleum of the Catholic Church and saying, you know, it's time for us to be open and acknowledge the faith, all faiths. And so I participated. I was teaching at a Catholic school, the Madeleine, on the north side of Berkeley.
Uh-huh.
And we got together with other ministers and people from other congregations throughout Berkeley and talked about certain issues and points, et cetera, and organized co-sponsored activities. I taught summer school to teenagers with a Presbyterian minister. And it was quite an opening, an eye-opener to me in many ways about the many... about the spirit in each of us and how similar, you know, when you get down to the essence, how similar all the world religions are.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing about interfaith that comes up sometimes is people sometimes are afraid that the idea of interfaith means we should assimilate or merge our faiths. And it doesn't mean that at all. It means that every different faith is valuable. And you know, and how can we hold our own faith and believe whatever we choose to believe and also respect and honor and be curious about our friends, our neighbors, you know, the people who have faiths that are very different from ours. And one of the most fascinating things about my own training as an interfaith minister is I went to and participated in many other faiths' services. And I spent much of my time studying Judaism. And, you know, I had, like here, we all know who the Sikhs are, our friends who live often, many of them live in one area collectively up in Española, and we recognize them because of their very distinctive attire. They wear white, the men and women wear turbans, and yet I knew very little about what Sikh was all about, what did that mean, until I went to seminary, and it occurred to me, wow, I could just go up there and go to their services. And, you know, who knew? Of course, we all can. They're open. They'd love to have you as a guest. And I went up and I participated in a beautiful service. And I heard various lectures by people and read about the Sikh religion and went, wow, this is a beautiful, beautiful religion with which I have no quarrel. And that changes our lives when we can do that, when we can see our neighbors as ourselves. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm perceiving a common thread in your life of really working around the core of human essence and the value of each human being and recognizing the wholeness of each human being.
Right. It's true. There, you know, when I left journalism and decided to become a minister, and I am still writing. I've been doing some writing for Pasatiempo, as a matter of fact. But when I shifted careers, I thought, I'm leaving journalism behind and I'm leaving that person behind and what I did. And And what I found out is that all of the same skills come into play. As a journalist, what did I do? I talked to dozens of people every day. I interviewed people. I learned how to draw people out and get them to tell me their stories. And, you know, as a minister, I do the same things, just with a different outcome. And it is, I am, like, at heart, I'm just a populist. I you know, I like people, and I want to know people's stories, and I want to connect with them on a deep level. So, right. Yeah, you're right. There is kind of this interesting thread.
Hey, Hollis,
yeah.
Guess what Elaine just called?
Oh, yay.
Yay.
So, Mary Lynn, we got to talk about this on the air with our friends listening.
Yes.
Since it's 8:24 and we have only until 9 o'clock, do you think I could go till 8:40 with Elaine?
I think so.
Okay, and then you'll let our other segment, our other person, know about that.
Okay.
Okay.
So here she is.
Thank you. Good morning, Elaine. How are you?
Oh, good morning. How are you?
I'm so sorry. We had some trouble getting started this morning, but I want to mention again that Elaine is the playwright of Secret Things. It's a new play, a world premiere that opened at the National Hispanic Cultural Center in Albuquerque, and it's still going on there this weekend. It will be opening in Santa Fe August 16 for 2 weekends at Teatro Paraguas. So, Elaine, tell us about this play, Secret Things.
Well, I wrote this play as a resident writer at the Arizona Theater Company. We had received a $100,000 grant for me to do 2 pieces, and I decided to do 2 pieces set in New Mexico. And so I went to Santa Fe, and I was working on a piece about Padre Martinez. And while I was in the archives in Santa Fe, I met a guy who was hanging out and doing his research, and it turned out that it was Stanley Hornets. And he told me he was working on the subject of crypto-Judaism. And I told him that, you know, my family, I think they might have that background. I'm not sure. I always thought I'd be interested in writing a play about that. So when he told me that he was a specialist in the subject, he also suggested, well, when you're ready to write that play, call me. And so I did, and I took a trip to Santa Fe, and he gave me a whole bunch of research, articles to look at, movies to watch, and most importantly, he gave me people to interview. And so I literally drove all around New Mexico in my car interviewing people about the subject of crypto-Judaism. And so the play, Secret Things, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, for people who don't know what crypto-Judaism is, why don't you give us the Cliff's Notes?
Yeah, the cliff notes are that there are people in New Mexico who self-identify as having historical Jewish roots, and that maybe they had some sort of residual Jewish practices in their family that they didn't understand, or perhaps, in the case of crypto-Judaism, the family practiced Judaism inwardly, but Catholicism outwardly. And so maybe members of the family knew or did not know about the family's Jewish history. And so in the subject of A Secret Thing, my character finds out that her mother knows the family has a Jewish background, but has chosen to be Catholic. And so it's the journey of her uncovering her family's Jewish past.
And we should say that these families you're talking about are Hispanic families in
yes,
New Mexico.
Yes, they are. Yes, that's exactly right. That is exactly right.
Right.
And so this idea, and, you know, it is known, and Stanley knew this, having done his research, that in Mexico it was well accepted that Latinos had these Jewish roots, but it wasn't well known or accepted in the Southwest at the time that I was doing the research on the play, which was in the 90s or the early, you know, 2000. And so, you know, I think the perceptions have changed over time, and we even changed the setting of the play, the time period of the play, to be the 1990s. So,
right. So tell us about your protagonist, Delia.
Well, she's a journalist. She lives in New York. She's somewhat estranged from her family back in New Mexico. She's been very career-oriented. She's an only child. She is her father's daughter. Her father's a physicist, very bright, and has raised her very much to be kind of like a guy and just go out and make her way in the world. And her mother is much more traditional. And in the course of the play, her editor asked her to go to New Mexico to do research about the crypto-Jews, to debunk this idea that this could possibly be true. And he happens to be Jewish also. He's a New York magazine editor. He sends her there, and when she gets there, she begins to uncover her family's own Jewish past, and it changes everything for her. It changes her perception of herself and of her life, and it takes her on a journey, and she ends up on a journey where she dreams of her family's Jewish past and is sent to this other location of Sephardia in her dreams. And in Sephardia, she sees her family's uninterrupted Jewish history.
So during the course of writing this play, didn't you find out some interesting things about yourself?
I did. I found out through a fellow playwright that I was probably related to an actress that he'd worked with for many years in San Francisco, and that her family and my family were from the same little part of New Mexico called Anton Chico, and that we have the same last name. And she suggested that I go meet her mother to figure out what our family relationship might be, and I did. And when I went to meet her mother came out with 500 years of family history.
Wow.
And in that family history, I saw, and I couldn't believe this, here I was, I had all the articles from Stanley. I was working so hard trying to understand what could have happened, and I wasn't even thinking about myself or my life or my family. I was just a writer working on a project. And here I am sitting in my hotel in Santa Fe, and I see five family names from whom I'm directly descended that are in my documents for people who had been persecuted by the Inquisition in Santa Fe for being Jewish. And it was shocking, amazing. I couldn't believe it was in front of me. It was like, I can't believe I'm holding this document. And all the circumstances that had to happen for me to have that document were sort of crazy. I mean, like, I had to go see this woman's mother. She had to bring out the family history. I mean, all these little pieces had happened.
Right.
And it was almost like through no effort of my own that everything came together and everything sort of just gelled together and I was able to do the work. And I think, you know, it's amazing to me what happens with writing because, you know, I don't think it's necessarily luck. I don't know if you call it the universe conspiring or what you want to call it. But we take on these projects, and there's no way we can do all the research that we need to do them. You know, to actually,
right.
For me to understand this subject could have taken me many years. But it was just the right people in the right place with the right level of generosity. You know, when I've been thinking about the play as it's in production right now, I've thought a lot about the people who I interviewed. People who were willing to talk to me, you know, off the record about their own histories and to share very deep details about their lives and what it meant to them for them to uncover their Jewish past. And I know that those interviews are really what fed the play, you know, the idea that human beings live these lives. And,
right.
You know, these are the lives that I'm uncovering in this play. And so I really found myself thinking a lot about the people that I interviewed. About, you know, what that takes to reveal yourself to someone you don't know and for them to trust mm-hmm. me as just a playwright who walks in the door, you know,
right.
That's like a deep level of trust.
Yeah.
And I'm super grateful to them, I mean, to this day. Yeah. And, of course, Stanley, if I hadn't had his material to stand on, I wouldn't have had anything. So
right.
I still consider him, you know, he's really, so with him, the play just couldn't exist at all. I wouldn't have even attempted the subject
uh-huh.
Because I think it is important. If you are dealing with historical ideas and material, you know, to really investigate it. And so he had done all that legwork over many years. You know, his work had not even been published
at
the time that I did my
right.
work. Yeah. And now, of course, it has. But,
oh, and now
but,
there
you
are.
Know, he
now
was
there
willing
are.
To share unpublished material. And I have to say, in both of my big historically based Mexican plays, and I will add The Secret Things as a Contemporary Story, scholars were willing to share unpublished material, and I was able to write those plays.
Mm-hmm.
And if they hadn't been, you know, those plays wouldn't exist. So I'm super grateful to them.
Right. It was just a thing whose time had come, and I know I share that idea as a journalist, how many times I have asked someone to tell me their story, and they, not knowing me, not knowing what I was going to do with that, open their hearts and just share. And this is such tender information about one's personal faith and one's history. And among some of the crypto Jews, we talked about this before, some of these people, their family was Catholic, as far as they knew, for, you know,
right.
centuries. And yet there was some little ritual that they did at home, like they lit candles every Friday night, but they didn't know why. Or, as I mentioned,
right.
my friend, the photographer, Carrie Hertz, had photographed the cemeteries around New Mexico, where people whose families had Jewish histories, hidden Jewish histories, were buried and found symbols of Judaism on these Catholic graves. And so,
right.
yeah, so the play is partly about our secrets, right?
Right. Yeah, and this idea that, you know, we know the truth somewhere deep inside. You know, my character has a memory of a moment that is replayed three times in the play until you see the moment fully realized. And it's the moment where she witnessed something in her family that she couldn't understand, that had always troubled her. And in the course of the play, she comes to understand what that moment meant. And that becomes the key and the secret that she unlocks in the course of the play. You know, one of the things that really inspired me a lot, and this is going to sound crazy, is physics. My brother is a theoretical physicist. My entire time in college, he worked on his theories, and he would sit me down and just talk at me and say, Elaine, you know, this is what I think. And he would explain all these things about physics. And in the course of that, not only was I interested in his passion for physics, because he has the same passion for physics that I have for playwriting, which is intense. And in the course of that, I noticed that there were certain beliefs that he had about how the world was structured and how the universe might be structured. And it had to do with, you know, ideas that parallel existences could maybe perhaps be real. And so when I literally dreamt of this place that I later called Sephardia, where a person might have this uninterrupted Jewish past, I realized that my character could also have these parallel existences, and that I could be, you know, working my way as a writer to creating a world in which people might appear as one person in one scene and another person, like a reflection of that former person, but be a little bit different in the next scene. And so that's what I've done with the double casting. All the double casting feeds in to the scenes that come before. And it sounds kind of complicated, but just the idea is that my character can live these lives that have multiple shades and varieties. And this idea that being Catholic and being Jewish and being Native can all coexist inside the same person. And that's what the play attempts to show and reveal through these different worlds.
So it's also about identity, how we identify ourselves, how external circumstances dictate who we think we are.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is very much about identity. And this idea that for some people, and this is true of the people that I interviewed, and that some of them felt like they never understood their lives until they understood this piece. That suddenly everything that confused them in life made sense, and everything was coming together. And so for me, that was really, really interesting, you know, this idea that this piece of information perhaps, but maybe it's even stronger in a family where it's not just on a piece of paper, but you can look back and say, oh, my family was actually practicing Shabbat, but I didn't know it.
Right.
They were hiding it from me. And why didn't they tell me? And why did they hide it from me? And I think in my character's life, she feels betrayed, you know. She really can't believe they would hide anything from her. She knows she's estranged from them, and yet she feels incredibly close to her parents. And she can't imagine that there would be anything they wouldn't tell her. And it becomes very clear in the course of the play that her mother knew everything.
Uh-huh.
And maybe her father less so, but her mother knew everything and chose not to tell her.
Yes.
Because her mother had decided to have this Catholic life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that's... And, you know, and people that I met who I interviewed have been raised Catholic.
Right.
They've been confirmed. You know, all of it was there for them. And they were going to Mass with their parents, and some of their parents were still Jews.
Right. Yeah. Elaine, we don't have too much time left, so I want to get a little bit of your personal background. You are sort of like a New Mexican who was expatriated before birth, right?
Exactly. My grandparents moved to San Diego, as many people did. My grandfather was a Marine. He fought in Iwo Jima, very proud of that, being a 5th Marine. And he and his uncles, who he was raised with like brothers, had relocated to the San Diego area. And I was raised in Orange County, but visiting them all the time and around a very New Mexican family. You know, my uncles had turkeys that they had in the backyard that they would grow in San Diego. You know, they'd have their turkeys. And we'd wait for these packages to come from New Mexico, Chile, and all these crazy things and piñons, and we'd fight over them. And so I was raised in a New Mexico way, New Mexican way in California. And then I went back eventually in my adult life, spent most of my adult life up to this point living in Tucson, Arizona, until I relocated to Chicago a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and so you've also written, you mentioned the two plays, this play and the play you did about Padre Martinez, but
yes.
you've written something like 76 plays, right?
I have, and all sorts of different subjects, you know, many Latino-oriented plays, many plays that I think would be great to see and hear in New Mexico. It's been the passion of my life, other than my husband and my family. It has been playwriting. And, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have my plays produced around the country and in other parts of the world and to have things published. And it's just been a very blessed existence to be able to be a professional writer, to be able to attend rehearsal and be part of a process and to change my work as I listen to it and to revise my plays. And it's just been great. It's taken me everywhere. I never dreamed that writing would give me such a big world. And I never dreamed that my plays would be in other countries or in other languages. And it's been really, really a remarkable thing. I had very humble expectations for my life. And
well, thank you.
You know, the writing's changed a lot of things. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I've been talking with Elaine Romero, playwright of Secret Things. It's a new play about the crypto-Jewish tradition of New Mexico. It's at the National Hispanic Cultural Center in Albuquerque right now and will open in Santa Fe on August 16th for 2 weekends at Teatro Paraguas. If you're going to be in Albuquerque this weekend, the play will be Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. at the National Hispanic Cultural Center. You can call for tickets, 505-724-4771, or go online to nationalhispaniccenter.org. And if you'd like to see the play here in Santa Fe, you can call Teatro Paraguas at 424-1601 or just go to their website, TEATROPARAGUAS, in case I'm not saying it clearly enough, teatroparaguas.org. The play opens here August 16th for 2 weekends. Showtime is on Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. And I think it's about time for us to take a little break here so we can go on to our second segment. So we're going to take a break. Please stay tuned to the Radio Cafe.